As I start this out, I generally start it out and address it to you. You're the one that's going to type it, I hope. I don't know how you want to word that or anything. Anyway, I guess if it's all addressed to you, I wouldn't think anybody would take offense at it. Now let's see if this is picking up right. This is a new tape. I thought here I would enter in my scouting experience. Did a little scout work. I just took a drink. Trying to bring me a drink in and get a little dry and talking. And I'm always optimistic. I'm a little pessimistic when I see a man get up to the pulpit and have a drink. And I think, guys, that's going to be a dry sermon. But anyway, I'm going to tell you about my scouting experience. I turned 12 years old in January of 1932. And if my memory serves me right, that was the year that they planned a two-week trip to Yellowstone. And I don't know, I believe we went up there in July, I'm not sure, but Vern Weiser was the scoutmaster. Saul Heyer had been our bishop, but they had released him. He was in the bishop when they planned this trip, and they put him in as first counselor in the stake presidency to President Pond. Put Dave Henriksen bishop. And he planned that trip, and so he planned that he was bishop, and it made the change, but that's all right, he came along anyway. Now, I think this trip was made either in July or August, I'm not sure, but Wayne Weiser took his truck. He had an old truck, beat box on it. They built some seats along down there so we could ride along there and watch. And they had a pole over the top so we could pull a tarp over if it rained. And there was a seat, and they counted the seats, and they counted the noses. And it seems like I paid $5 for my share of that trip. That's a lot of money, and then took about 3.5, I believe, with me for spending money, and that included my meals for this 2 weeks. Bert Wheeler went along with us. He was on the scout committee. Never did forget him. He chewed a little good tobacco, guess it was good. And then he'd spit and ride down there, and the wind would carry down. Every kid down that side would have to wipe their arm or their face or something of that tune. We finally kicked up a lot of fuss and tried to get him to ride the back. And he said that'd make him sick to get in the back. And I don't know whether I ever got him to ride the back or not. We tried. But up there, he was a good fisherman, and we had a lot of good fish. The work he'd done, the fishing he'd done. Well, Wayne Weiser was a character. Always had a lot of fun, always in on a lot of fun. He'd rigged up a shocking machine some way, and he had a wire down that hook right down the sideboards and around that truck. He shocked every kid every day. And he just couldn't hardly sleep at night. So bears would come around. We weren't required to stay in campgrounds. Sometimes we did. They generally didn't want us in campgrounds. That many scouts, they didn't want you around if they could get away with it. A bear would come up snooping around there, and old Wayne, he'd slip out of his tent and into that cab of that truck. Turn that shocker on. Yeah, at night, he'd put some bears into some of the finest demonstrations that ever happened. I remember when we came to Mount Washburn. They was going to, if you wanted to see Mount Washburn, you had to walk up there and then walk down the other side, and Wayne was going to drive around, meet you around the other side. His truck wouldn't go up over it. I didn't hardly think that was worth it, but everybody else went, so I went. I was just 12 years old. Some of those kids was pretty good-sized kids. And going up over Mount Washburn, I almost give out. Arthur Van Arden was a couple or 3 years older than me, and he did give out. Great big kid, good land. He was about 14 years old then, and weighed 25 to 50 pounds. He's a big guy. He's bigger than he is now, I believe. Got his growth early. And coming down the other side, he'd give out. Laid down in the shade of a tree and said, I'm going to die. So I sat down there by him, and I kind of enjoyed the rest anyway. And I didn't think they'd leave us. We come a-sauntering into camp, into the tour the truck was. Everybody was there but us. Oh, they did ride us. And they give us bad time. Oh, dear, a bunch of kids give us real bad treatment. Anyway, we survived it. Along into that second week was my first experience of being homesick. Oh, good land, I was homesick. I could have bawled if it'd done any good. I'd never been away from home. Good land, I'd lived all those years right here and been down to Logan. Oh, good old Bear Lake time too. See Grandpa before he died. Anyway, the darn kids got to stealing. We had a few on there that were real good at that. As we left the park, either Brother Heyer or Vern White or somebody caught on to it. So when we pulled out of the park, they pulled over side the road. And the scoutmaster gave a speech. President Heyer gave a speech. And then I didn't even know about it. I didn't even know about the stealing. That first time out, I didn't know about it. And I'm not going to put any names in here, but one kid stole a lot of stuff. And he'd caught wind that they was going to check him. So he put it in another kid's suitcase. And the kid didn't know anything about it. When they opened up everybody's suitcase, this one guy that had all the loot said, good land, where'd this come from? Many years later, Stephen Arden said to me, he was on that scout trip, and he mentioned this, and he said, I was surprised that that kid stole all that stuff. And I said, good land, did you know who stole that stuff? And then I told him, and I said, and he stashed it in that other guy's suitcase. And he said, you know, for all these years, I didn't know that. And anyway, when we got home, well, I didn't say anything about it. This one particular boy, his mother came to my mother and said, did you know those kids stole all that stuff up there and your boy was in on it? And she said, no, I didn't know anything about it. I'll question him. And she said, well, you better. Went on and on and on. And I laughed. So mother asked me about it. Mother and Dad, and I laughed, and I said, that was a potlicker that stole the stuff, most of it, and stashed it in his other kid's suitcase. Now, how come she's down here yakking about me? I haven't stolen anything. Dad and Mother said, well, that's all right, we believe you. That's fine. That's fine. We're glad you didn't do it, and we believe you. I was kind of grateful for parents who believed me when I tell them the truth, and I didn't really mean to lie to him. But then the next year, I believe it was the next year, we went up Logan Canyon for a week of scout camp. The old scout camp used to be up there, oh, I don't know, They did away with it. Went over to Bear Lake. But anyway, we went up there. Jim Last was one patrol leader, and Bert Orchard was the other one. But Bert got sick, and so his assistant patrol leader, Howard McGee, was the patrol leader. We had two patrols, and we went up to Scout Camp. We hustled in there, and our truck driver got us up there in pretty good time. And so we hustled in there and picked out a place for our camp. Some of the officials, and I never did know who it was, come along and said, "Hey, you can't have that camp. We're not going to let anybody use that camp." So we moved over to another site and said, "Can we have this one?" They said, "Yeah." Then another troop came in, I think from Logan, I'm not sure now. And they let them have that campsite because that was the only one left. And then when they came in, we were a little bit ticked off when they come around and judged everybody's camp. And they went over and judged this camp where we picked out and wanted in the first place. And said, "Well, we've got to give this camp because they picked the best place." Have you ever heard a bunch of kids grumble? And I didn't mind hiking in those hills, but I always thought I'd have my saddle horse with me. You know? We started on that long track up to see Old Juniper. And I got so tired walking up that mountain. Me and another kid, I'm not sure who, sit down on the side and said, "Now, if Old Juniper's been there that long, it can wait till someday when we got a horse and we ride up to it, but we ain't gonna walk on foot." But we sit there and wait till the kids come back, and then we walk back down the canyon with them. But I remember Preston Pond. He was George Pond's brother. Was the scout executive, and he dressed up like an Indian and put on a war dance, made fire with turning a stick into another stick with a little bowl with a string on it. He put on quite a show, and I thought that's pretty good. And they did a few things, and I didn't get homesick that year. And I kind of realized, and I believe that was the last of my scouting. I didn't do much in scouting. I believe I got a first class, I'm not sure. But at this camp, why, Tedburn Heisel was in our patrol. I don't know, Jim was it. Those patrol leaders, I guess they, little authority went a long ways. And Jim chased us all out of camp, and Howard McGee chased these kids all out. Oh, I don't know. I believe it was Marvin Jorgensen. I'm not sure. Anyway, one of the kids was sitting up on that mountain with me waiting. Things calmed down, so we go back down in there. And I was sitting right there, two great big bull thistles. And I said, "Now look, if I take my pocket knife and cut right down in the root of this, you slip in that tent and put that in old Hard McGee's bed. And I'll slip in that tent and I'll put this other one in Jim Last's bed." And that's just what we did. We slipped down there right quiet and come around and tried to make peace with them, said we'd wash the dishes or something. And at night after dark, and we went to bed. Howard McGee rolled over on that thistle, tore his tent right down. He thought a snake bit him. And old Jim Last laid over there laughing and rolled over and got his bull thistle. And he about tore that tent down. Now, they wondered for a long time. We never did admit that. Now, some years later, I was over here milking cows. We weren't in the scouts then, we was older. And the scouts had camped down on the Cannibal, back out in one of those pastures. They had a good camp down there, and they was doing a lot of signaling, and they was getting by fine. Jim Last came over, and he said, let's go down there and scare those kids. I said, well, I've got to finish milking my cows. So he stuck around. I got my cows milked, and we got in the car and drove down there. Then we parked out in the road, walked off across the pasture, and when we got to them, the creek, where High Creek comes down, and heading for Cub River, the creek was between us and the scout camp. And I said, well, Jim, as far as I go, I'm not going to wade that creek. That creek's high and that creek's cold. Well, he said, I'll show you how to do that. I'll just walk right across these limbs that's here. And I said, well, go ahead. I'll stand right here and watch you. Well, the creek had kind of washed out around those logs that was laying there and limbs. And it was deep and it was cold. Right out of the snow, that water was. Old Jim walked out on that brush, and down through that brush he went, and in that cold water, and he scared those cows, scouts, all right, because he let out the blood curdling scream, just curdle your blood. They had to pull him out of the ditch, pull him out of the creek, stand him over there and get him warm, get him dried up so I could take him home. Scouting's a good thing. You can get away from home a little bit once in a while and kind of get over being homesick and kind of start weaning your kids. Well, let's think here a minute. So we went up to Lava Hot Springs, and Dad soaked in that hot water to help out his rheumatism. Howard went along the chauffeur. Howard was generally the family chauffeur through my lifetime, at least. I don't know who they left around here to milk, but it don't matter. But anyway, I wasn't in school, so I got to go. And I guess Reed and Owen must have milked Horace. Unless Horace was on a mission. He could have been on a mission. But anyway, May was around here to get to cook for him or something. But anyway, we went up to Lavin and stayed a day or so. Dad soaked in that hot water, his rheumatism, and he got to feel a little better and went on to Soda Springs. Now, I don't know whether you kids have ever been there. They brag about that good soda water at Soda Springs water. There's a place there you can get you a drink. Dad, he always liked that mineral water. And of course, that was supposed to be the fountain of youth, I guess. Every country has their fountain of youth. That's supposed to heal a lot of things. Anyway, I never did like it. People used to brag about it. It was about like driving a Ford tractor and milking Jersey cows. You had to brag about it to be contented, I guess, but I never did like the darn stuff. I thought if you had to go through all that suffering just to have a little water, well, you might as well drink something else. But Dad stopped there, and we stopped there, and he tanked up on that water, and he liked it. We headed out and headed for Bennington, and over there, and those old roads were dirt roads, ruts, deep. There was those couple Model T's had high wheels so they could straddle and into the ruts and go along. And you'd go along those deep old ruts, and you wouldn't see a car all day long. Wasn't many cars. And we was going down this hill. Georgetown Divide. Dad said, stop, I've got to go to the toilet. Well, so Howard stopped, and we didn't have any paper there, anything for use for toilet paper. Dad got out, and squatted down around behind the car and said, "Howard, would you go get me something to use for toilet paper?" And the only thing he could find was some old ripe foxtail that had lasted through the winter. Well, I don't know what. And as he brought that back to Dad, and Dad said, "My golly, boy, I've raised you and taught you all I know. And I send you after toilet paper, and all you bring me is ripe foxtail." And my mother sat there and laid her head on that seat in front of her. I think she was in the back. Her and I rode in the back and laughed till tears run right down her face. And I kidded hard about that throughout the years, but that was the funniest sight. He always maintained that there wasn't anything else. And I guess maybe that was about right. But I remembered that story. Well, Judy, I'm going to start on a story now that's never been told. I'm a little lost for words as I tell it. I'm going to tell about my courting years. I don't tell this in any bragging or any... I was no Rudolph Valentino. I was no great lover, and I do not tell this for only one thing in mind. As my kids come along and my grandkids come along, and whoever gets to read this or hear this, whenever somebody loses a girl or loses a boyfriend, oh, the stories are always written about those who win. They always tell about somebody else who loses. But I'm going to tell you about me. I came out second many times. I went with good girls. I never got serious. I spent most of the time, the last 2 years I was here, with the Vernetta Larson from Glencoe. But I never got serious because I wanted to go on a mission and I didn't want anything stopping me. So as I left on a mission, I wrote to three girls. I wrote to Melba Clayson, I wrote to Vernetta Larson, I wrote to Nada Packer. Three fine girls. When I came back from my mission, I went to see Melba, and she was engaged to be married, and so I didn't go back. Went to see Vernetta, and she was engaged, and didn't go back. I went some with Nada, but that didn't work out. But anyway, I'm going to throw in here. I told part of this story back here some time ago. Anyway, I took Melba's picture and put it in my wallet. And when I was with Elder Wigil, I couldn't get through those girls, a crowd of girls that flock around us after cottage meetings. I'd take my wallet out and show my wife. And they just back off me like poison. Well, Elder Wigil and I went to conference. I'm going to get this story and then I'll go back to the court. But anyway, in Elder Wigil's testimony, he said, "President Whitaker, you have me assigned to an elder that's a liar." And at that, President Whitaker turned to me and said, "What's he talking about?" And I said, "President Whitaker, you remember you was a country elder when you was a boy down here on the mission. And those girls flock around us until I can't get out of there. Somebody's got to get out." I said, "The typical cottage meeting is the big old hall or room, wherever you are. They put you in front of the fireplace to preach, and you have to preach loud enough to all the people in the house and all those out in the yard can hear you. And I said, I do that. Now I said, the front rows are lined up with teenage girls that have worked all summer long in the cotton fields, and they've got enough money to buy a decent outfit and some war paint. And I said, I wish somebody would teach them how to put the paint on. They put it on so thick that I said, if you ever kissed one of those girls, you'd die of painter colic anyway. And I said, at the end of the meeting, they flock around you. We're the only guys they ever see in a suit. And I can't get out of there. I've got to get back. I said, in the back of the room are the wives and the mothers and the babies laying on the bed or whatnot, and the mothers tend them, and the old men who rule the roost are outside a whittling and a spitting. And those are the guys that invite you to stay. And we're on foot. We gotta have an invitation to stay. And when I introduce them to my wife, they just back off of me like poison, and I can get out of there and outside and shake hands with all those old spitters. And they say, hey, preacher, you gonna stop at our place? And that's where we get a place to stay the next night. President Whitaker laughed, and he said, I wish I'd have done that when I was a boy, because I was married. And it had been legal. And so he turned back to Elder Wigel, and he said, Elder Wigel, while you've been with Elder Rollins, have you slept out one night under the stars? No. Have you ever missed a meal? No. Well, don't complain too bad at him. He said he's doing you a favor, I believe. Good land, maybe if that girl have him when he gets home, might even be prophecy. But anyway, she's never heard this story, no. I've never told her. But anyway, then Wigel said, well, he preaches false doctrine. And so President Whitaker turned back and said, what's he talking about? And I said, I don't know, ask him. So Elder Wigel said, well, the other night, we were staying at a place, and a lady said, well, and she was speaking of the old Bible, said Cain married Nate. And the Lord said, you didn't either. Said, the Bible don't say that. Said, well, where'd he get a wife? He said, he pulled out his pearl of great price, and he told her a little of the pearl of great price, and that it was scripture. And he went on to tell Pearl of Grace Price said he took his brother's wife to daughter, and he went back to the Bible to show that the Bible said Adam and Eve had many sons and daughters. And he said, and he don't have the right to teach out of that Pearl of Great Price. And President Whitaker said, who told you he didn't have the right to teach out of the Pearl of Great Price? Well, Wigel said, well, the only place we're supposed to teach out is out of the Bible. And he said, I never did tell you that. He said, I think Brother Elder Rollins is clear on both counts. And so I thought I'd finish that story. Now back to my courting years. I started courting, I don't know, 14 or 15 years old. Reed used to say to Dad, he'd say, I thought maybe I'd take Lynn to the show. He didn't really care about taking me to the show. He just wanted an excuse to get the car. And so I started going with him earlier than a man ought to go, than a kid ought to go. So that meant I courted for 10 years or better, except the time I was on a mission. I never courted on a mission. I taught the Lord's gospel and not mine. When I come home, no girl followed me home. And no way. But anyway, as I got home from my mission, let's see, I got to see what I've said here. I'll check out here in just a minute. Judy, as I proofread this, I discovered that I misquoted that Cain married his brother's daughter. Took his brother's daughter to wife. I missed part of that as I was saying it. Okay, now we're about the end of tape, but anyway, we're going to get going on this. Now, as I started to cook, well, I'd start all over again. I went hither and yon, different girls. My health wasn't too good. And I wasn't really hunting a wife this time. Because I knew I had to get better health, and I had to get some things straightened out. Not about broke anyway. Need a little time to get things going. I needed time to feel better. Peck got home from his mission soon after I did. And we chased around together. And anyway, I think it was in the year 1944. I started going with a girl. We kind of fell into going to each other. We'd known each other ever since high school. We went to high school together. She was a year younger than I was. I'm not going to put her name on here. I've never seen her since. And she was an excellent dancer. We danced real good together. We got along good. And we started going together in that spring of 1944. See, I'd been home a year and a half. And as the summer wore on, we went everywhere, a lot of things together. She had things to do, and I went with her, and I had things to do, and she went with me. I didn't really plan to fall in love with her. Nothing against her. She was a good gal. She could be married in the temple, and that's where she was eventually. And that's where I could have taken her. As long into the later part of the year, got real attached to her. She had all the qualities. I thought she graduated from college while we'd been fiddling around. She was teaching school in Preston. Well, as it wore on, and she had sent a boy on a mission many years before, and he'd come home and went right in the army, and he was over in England in the army. And she didn't really know what the status was. They still wrote. She used to let me read his letters. I said, "See, I don't know if there's anything there or not." But long later in the year, I think 1944 was, I thought I'd fell in love with her. There wasn't any reason that I shouldn't have had her. Did I? Maybe that's not the right wording for a man 58 years old to tell what happened when he was 24 years old. It's quite a thing. But anyway, and so after I'd rehearsed a speech to myself many times, I told her one night that I loved her, and I'd ask her to marry me. As I remember now, she didn't answer. And we went on together for a few more times. After about a week, she brought the subject back up. And I was waiting for an answer. I wasn't waiting for the answer I got. But she went on in as diplomatic a way as she could. And she said she was sorry. That probably she had led me to this point. but she still wanted to wait for that boy in England, in the service. And so she declined the offer and recommended that maybe we not go together anymore. That was a kind of a hard blow. I thought I'd thought this out straight. I thought I'd figured it out. I thought I'd prayed about it. Anyway, of course I realized, and always did, that she had as much right to say no as I did to ask her. And so, the last time I saw her a time or two as we discussed this, and she said, you might as well come till we get through discussing it and you're satisfied with it. And I said, well, this is hard to say, but as I think this over, if you don't want me, then it's best that I don't want you. Now, that was hard to say, and as I left her, I don't remember ever talking to her again. I've only seen her at a distance a time or two. I've never talked to her since then. This was, what, either October or November of 1944. Now, I've never said a bad thing about this girl, neither before that or after, nor during it. And I remember I was living here alone. I was working in the sugar factory and trying to get everything going. And I felt real bad. I believe the word would be heartbroken. Somebody told me along that line, who had just gone through a situation of that, said, Lynn, you're entitled to 2 weeks of mourning and no more. He said when he went through it, somebody told him that he could have 2 weeks of mourning, that was all. So about that time, and I said, well, I believe that's good advice. I know I was laying here in the house one night, all soul alone, nobody else in the house, and this wasn't uncommon. Thinking over my situation and wondering why. And I heard my mother say, Lynn. And I spoke out loud and said, all right, Mother, I'll quit it. And I felt better after that. Now the girl married the boy that she sent on a mission, went through the army. And they were married in the temple, as they should have been. So far as I know, I've never heard of her for many years. They live in the Salt Lake area and raised a fine family. I don't know how big, don't know anything about them. And that day lives. I've often thought about the script writer in the show Ten Commandments, and I believe they must have had that in mind. As Moses asked the daughter of Jethro to be his wife, she accepted. In her acceptance speech, she said something like this: I'll not be jealous of a memory. And I hope maybe that Julia feels the same way, because she didn't know much about this story. I never told her. But as I left her, the sugar factory was over and I needed a job for the winter. I got on the railroad, on the bridge and building crew stationed at Cache Junction, And that used to, they had to cook there, had my meals there. I worked there all winter, crawled through all the culverts from Cache Junction to McKeown. And I used to go into Logan at times. Gotta tell you this one, I went to Salt Lake one weekend. Tedburn Heisel was down there and he was in med school. And Arthur Van Arden had come home from Europe and he was stationed as a MP at the Union Station there in Salt Lake. So I went down there and I said, hey, I'll be back. And I used to go down there about every other week. I could catch a pass on the railroad and ride down there, and then I could come back and stop off where my bunk car was and get into the bunk car. And I made a pretty good arrangement. I'd stay with Ted. He had an apartment, and I'd stay with him. And those potlickers, they said, hey, you come back next week and we'll have a date for you. And I don't know what I ever done to those guys to deserve what they did to me. As I got down there, Ted's date had canceled out. She was sick or something, so he didn't have one. And Arthur had a date with Lois, the girl he ended up marrying, and I believe that was their first or second date. I don't know. But anyway, it was right the first day, of course. And they got me a date with a gal. And I'm not going to put her name on this either. But anyway, I just read and then I saw her, a picture of her and her dad, sometime later in the newspaper. I realized maybe what the problem was, but her dad was a professor at the University of Utah. And she had just completed a degree and she was a professor with him. Here was a father and a daughter, both professors at the faculty at the University of Utah. And as we started out that night, the five of us, we didn't have a car. We went where we went. We went on taxi or whatnot. And we went down town to the Desert Gym and watched Utah play some team. I think Wyoming, but I'm not sure. And then we went down the town and on over. Down Main Street, a little south of in the block south of the temple grounds, to the show house, to the show. And that was the most miserable night I ever spent, I believe, on a date. That girl. She cussed country kids all night. That's what we were, all three, just country kids. She never said one kind word to anybody, and she yacked at us every minute. Till I was never so sick of a date, and I kept thinking what I'd done to those two publicers or what I was going to do to get even with them. And as we came out of the show about midnight, she was still yacking. I got out of that show and I put my hat on, and as we started north up that sidewalk, and that sidewalk was just chock full of people, I said, this reminds me of the city man that came to the country. And he saw a little colt run around there in the farmer's yard. Gosh, that was a pretty little colt. He said to the farmer, where do you get those? The old farmer walked over to the squash patch and picked up a big old squash and came over and handed it to the city man and said, now if you'll take that squash and go out here in the sagebrush and sit on it for about 6 weeks, that's just what you'll hatch. Now that egg right there, he called it an egg. But he said, so the city man took the squash and went and got him some provisions so he could eat, have something to eat and to drink for that period of time, and he went out there and he sat on that squash. for about 5.5 weeks, and then he run out of food. And one warm day, he said, this acres, this will stay warm while I go get me something to eat. And on his way back, as he got just about to the squash, he saw a jackrabbit jump up and run through that sagebrush. And of course, it had long ears, just like the colt. And that old country boy, that old city boy, took off his hat. And at this stage of the game, I took off my hat, and I went over and I took a hold of the parking meter there, and I began to whirl that hat, and I was screaming just as loud as I could, "Here, Coldy, hish your mommy, here, Coldy, hish your mommy." And that girl ducked across the road and got on the trolley car and went home. I guess she went home. Ted said, "Why didn't you tell that story 3 hours ago?" And I said, "You pollockers, I don't know what I'll ever do, but the day'll come, I'll get even with you, but I don't believe I ever have." The next morning, as we went to church at the Institute at the University of Utah, as I walked up the steps and in the front door, I recognized the man over at the door of the chapel, shaking hands with everybody, as Cecil Reese, who grew up with us down here in Benson Ward, graduated with me from high school. He was down at the University of Utah studying chemistry. And as I walked up there, here stood this girl by him. As I walked up there, why, he grabbed me by the hand and said, "Lynn, will you give the opening prayer?" And I said, "Yes." And at that, she said, "Huh, if you talk to him, I'll have nothing to do with you," and took off down through the chapel. And old Cease grabbed me, and he said, "Now, you've got to stay with me when I get all this Sunday school in order. I got to know what happened." And I said, "It won't take long to tell." But that's anyway, one weekend, I came into Logan. Frank Nielsen had an apartment in Logan, and I came into Logan to stay with him over the weekend. And I didn't go home very often. Wasn't much here. Anyway, I had a key to his apartment. I came in along the night, walked down there and opened his door, which was locked. I expected him any minute. Took off my clothes, said my prayers, and went to bed. Gosh, I no more got stretched out in that bed. Here comes some wild Indian through that door and pounced onto me. And we wrestled and wrestled around and around over that bed and down on the floor. Finally, I got him down, held him down, and reached over and turned on the light. I'd never seen that kid before in my life. And he looked up at me, and he'd never seen me before. And he said, "I thought you were Frank." I said, "I assumed that. Now, who are you?" He told me his name. And he had to have something to say, so he started bragging about his girl. Well, he gave me such fine lingo about that girl of his, and the next night at the dance, he introduced her to me. And that was the first time I ever danced with Julia Whitney. And I danced with her occasionally that spring. They were going together, and I didn't get in on it then. But that next fall, he came back. He didn't come back to school. I don't know what happened to him. But that's when I started going with her. And so that was my introduction to Julia Whitney. I found something here that I hadn't found before. I remember taking her to down there at the apartment where Keith and Gwelda Clayson were living. He was going to school and they had one little girl, Judy. I told him, I introduced her. I had asked her to marry me about the first of quarter of February, 1946. We were married the 2nd of April, but I told Keith and Gwelda that we were planning to marry. Keith told me afterwards, he said, that's the best one you've gone with. And I said, hey, I went with your wife. And he said, well, I excluded her. I used to tell Keith the best thing I ever did for him was introduce him to Gwelda. Now, let's see, we ought to hear this, see what I... As I was getting ready to, Julia and I, to get married, as we're talking a little louder, I can't remember where I was, but I was dancing with Gwelda Clayson, and she started giving me a lingo. She said, now, have you taken that girl up and introduced her to your family? And I said, no, I hadn't even thought of it. And she said, you do that. No, she shouldn't marry you unless you take her up and introduce you to your family. And I said, well, I'm not going to meet hers until I get down there. Only one of her family I've met is Venice. And, well, it gave me quite a lingo, and quite convincing. And so I made arrangements and brought Julia up here to Lewiston and met Howard and Owen, Reed, Horace and the wives. I took her one down to see May and introduced her to May. I had left the railroad to But anyway, looking around, gosh, I wondered how to go down and get her. Keith had offered me his car, but Fred Vabel hadn't. He'd been married a few years. He was a cow tester here, and he and I associated quite a bit together. Got quite a bit of Fred and Grace. Fred said, we've never been on a honeymoon. Now, how are you going down to get there? And I said, I haven't really figured that out yet. He said, well, I've got to play a dance on April Fool's night. So if we'd leave here April Fool's night, midnight. And I said, well, I could go home, go to bed, sleep, be all ready to drive. Take turn driving, we'd be down there. Time to get married, get you married. And Grace and I'd go along, chaperone you on your honeymoon, said, we haven't really had a honeymoon. We just got married and went right on to work. And we think this is this thing due. And I said, well, by golly, that's the best offer I've heard. And so we got all lined up for that. Julia had drew me out a map how to get to her place when we get into Hurricane. And we got down there and about 9 o'clock in the morning. We left here at midnight. It was somewhere between 9 and 10 o'clock in the morning. We stopped in Cedar City and had breakfast. And got down there and drove into the yard. There stood her dad. He just milked the cows. Something, I think he had a bucket of milk in his hand. But anyway, he was standing out there. And here comes Julia running out of the house. Hair all done up in curls. She had a lot of hair on her head that time. And clear down, when she let it down, down to her shoulders. But anyway, come running out there and grabbed me. And she said, oh, I haven't slept all night. I kept afraid of fear that you wouldn't show up. I never thought of not showing up. But here we went in, got stirred around. I'd heard of hurricane. Hurricane, as we called it. Leon Sullivan from Hurricane was on a mission with me. I used to say to him, can anything good come out of Hurricane? And so, I think the temple session started at about 1 o'clock that we were going into. And we're going to have a reception that night. So Fred and Grace and Julie and I got quiet around, went over to St. George and had dinner and bought our license before noon. Got quiet around and we were up the temple at 1 o'clock ready to go. Our dad and mother was with us. None of my family was able to come. They didn't have a car that would make it. The war was over and so was all our automobiles. Velma said once, she said, you know, we'd have surprised all you people, you and Julia. There'd have been one car in the family that would have made it. And I said, well, wouldn't have been any surprise. Been welcome there. So we got married. Went back, and Dorothy and Harlan. Harlan was still in the service. Lived in a little Dorothy and Kenneth. Lived in a little house right there beside Dad and Mother's. I don't know where Dorothy went, but she said, hey, I'll give you the house for your honeymoon. And that's where we spent our first night. The next day, we got things saturated around, put some of her Julia's things in Fred's car. And Dad and Mother was coming up anyway at conference time a few days later, and they brought the rest of it. Anyway, then we went down to Las Vegas. She got to prowl around her pocket and found she had 50 cents. So she spent it on the slot. She always claimed to marry a girl. All she had was 50 cents. She spent that on the slot machine. And I believe I gave her that 50 cents. She was going to come to Lewiston on the train. And anyway, she didn't need 50 cents, but... And we went down, went through Boulder Dam, back and headed up home. Got home a day or two later. Peck and Blanche come down to meet her. We decided the four of us would go to Salt Lake for the 6th of April for conference. Went down there and saw some of those old cronies, and her dad and mother was up to conference, and got to talk to them. Anyway, we finally found a room to stay. We rented this room. Peck and I have talked about that. We rented the room and turned out the light. There's two beds, and by golly, we got in the bed with the right wife. And no problem. Then on in that year, Reed, when I got back home, we got around to farming. The crew was over to, we all put our crops in together. Went over to Horace's, that's where the crew was. Oh, hey, wait a minute, I got to tell this and all my mother-in-law's. We got ready to leave Whitney's and Hurricane's that next morning, April the 3rd. We got things sashayed around, got that car squared around, and got in that car. And there stood my mother-in-law. And she said, now Lynn, and of course realizing that she'd never seen me before until 9 o'clock the day before, here I'd come down, married her girl, and was taken off. Kind of a funny situation. And she said, now Lynn, I know Julie would be good to you, now you be good to her. And I said, oh, good land, I thought you'd be glad you rid her, you wouldn't even worry about that. And she broke into tears, and she bawled, and she bawled, and she bawled. I guess that's once putting my foot in my mouth. But anyway, I hadn't dealt with a mother for so many years that I didn't really know. And I fouled that one up. Judy got out and hugged her mother, and they hugged each other, and finally her mother quit bawling, and then we went sailing down the road. But I was glad to bring her home. This was a new life. I was glad to bring her here. I was no longer alone. I've been alone 10 years. I was no longer alone. And I was grateful to have her. As I've thought about this, finding her and bringing her here and she being my wife, I read something one time where a man said that there was one that you fell in love with and there's another one you thank God you married. Now, I loved Julia when I married her, but after all these years and all the struggles she's gone through, changes she's made to raise family for us, I love her more now than I did when I married her. Now, we've had quite a life together, and this tape here is about through, so I'm not going to...